Okay. Today we're going to talk about three sort of disjoint topics. First one is non-informative priors and invariants. Before we even get to this topic, we'll just go through what we have seen in the course till now, just to put a perspective on what we are going to talk today. So our main aim, goal in this course is to do pattern recognition, as the course name indicates. So in the second chapter, what we saw was Bayesian decision theory, which will help us do this pattern classification. But for using this Bayesian decision theory, we realized that what we use is posteriors. Do you know why we use posterior, why we use Bayesian decision theory for classification? Any idea? I mean, is it optimal in any sense? Yeah, but I can have some other classifier which incorporates prior knowledge. But it can give you absolutely, it's still a classifier, but it's not, we don't use it. Because Bayesian classifier is optimal in the sense of least classification error. Probability of error is least, overall probability of error. When we use posterior for classification. But we also saw variants of it, one of which was Minimax criterion. I think you should have seen it when Dr. Picconi talked about receiver operating characteristics. So that in that case, you minimized the maximum risk. But in the chapter, we saw, even though we can classify using Bayesian decision rule, so if we could do that, the whole course is over. But the main problem is, for us to do the classification, we have to know the posterior distribution. So where do you get the posterior distribution from? This, when I talk about posterior distribution and Bayesian decision theory, it is the posterior distribution of each class given data. So this is for classification. So for this, we will need the likelihood and the prior of class and data. So this leads, so for the prior of each class, we can either get the data from, say, assume we are doing a digital digital classifier or discrete classifier with, say, zeros and ones bits. So at the transmitter, we know how many the statistics of the bits that we send. We may send, say, about 70% zeros and only 30% ones. So in which case, we know the probability of zeros and ones. So this is the prior distribution for the class 0 and class 1. And for likelihood, we assume a parametric form. And now we get to the third chapter, which is parameter estimation. So even here we have got Bayesian methods, but this Bayesian method is not for classification, but for estimation of the parameters. And when we even with Bayesian estimation of parameters, we have the likelihood and the prior for the parameters. So the likelihood, if the priors had been equal, the Bayesian estimation would reduce to a maximum likelihood estimation. But it's not always that we can assume priors to be equal. In some cases, when it's discrete, we can assume it to be equal. Or even when it's not discrete, when it's continuous, say like when the problem at hand is finding the Gaussian mean, we still assume the priors to be equal. That is, it's a uniform distribution across the whole range of the mean. So such priors are known as non-informative priors. That is, this gives us no specific information about the prior of the parameters, but we can proceed with the Bayesian estimation by using these non-informative priors. Whenever we use non-primitive prayers, we design the prayer using one or two invariant conditions. So, if you see the first point here, the information about the prayer is based on the designer's knowledge of the problem domain. So, if we have some prior knowledge of the problem domain, so we can incorporate it. Like when we found priors for, say, classification with zeros and ones for bits. So, if, when we are transmitting at the transmitter end, when we are transmitting 70% of zeros and 30% of ones, we've got some prior probabilities for zeros and ones. So, similarly, we can do something like this even with parameter estimation, prior of parameters. But in a lot of cases, we don't know. We don't have any knowledge of what the prior distribution is. So, we assume some kind of translation or scale invariance for the parameters. But why do we do this? What is this invariance? For example, when we have a Gaussian mean, we will assume, if we don't have any knowledge, that the mean itself can be anywhere on the axis. So this is translation invariance. That is, wherever we shift the probability distribution, if we assume that we know the variance but not the mean, so we know the shape of the distribution, but we can shift this anywhere on the axis. So this is translation invariance, right? So our distribution should be, our prior distribution should be translation invariant for the mean. Such priors are called non-informative priors. They give us no prior information. But with this approach, so the Bayesian approach remains applicable even when little or no prior information is available. Such situations can be handled by choosing a prior density giving equal weights to all possible values of theta, like the mean in this case. But equal weight, you can't apply equal weights to all cases, as we will see in an example in the next slide. Priors that seemingly impart no prior preference, the so-called non-informative priors, also arise when the prior is required to be invariant under certain transformations. But the problem with this, with non-informative priors, is frequently the desire to treat all possible values of theta equitably leads to priors with infinite masses. Such non-informative priors are called improper priors. For example, if we assume the prior distribution of a mean of a continuous random variable is independent of the choice of origin, the only prior that could satisfy this is the uniform distribution, which isn't possible. Why? Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that's right. So either you assume probability at every point is zero, or if it's some finite probability, then overall probability is infinite. So such priors are called improper priors. But the advantage of using these is it's a non-informative prior. This is somewhat similar to some of the degenerate distributions, or say even white noise. What's the problem with white noise and random processes? Is it a practical random process? Right, it's exactly the same thing. So, it's got infinite energy. So, which is again not possible. So, whenever we deal with the theoretical issues, we'll be lax with such issues like energy and infinite probability. But in practice, since we have only a finite range, it'll automatically resolve itself. Because since it has a finite range, the range with which we are dealing is finite, it'll still be finite. The overall power, energy, or in this case probability, will still be finite. So in the first case, there we have a prior distribution of a mean when we assume it's uniform. It's non-informative prior, but it's improper. But it's still okay to do that because it will finally resolve itself when you go on iterating through several iterations of the Bayesian parameter estimation. For another example, which is not a translation with invariant prior, we consider the parameter sigma, which is the standard deviation. So in the case of sigma, a more desirable invariant is scale invariant prior. Say, when we have the standard deviation, what we want is the prior distribution should be invariant irrespective to what unit you are dealing with. We can deal with, say, maybe if it's some kind of distance, you can deal with meters, inches, feet. Whatever be the case, the prior should give you no information about it. It should be, it should give equal information or no information for whatever unit you are dealing with. So when you cross from one unit to another unit, what you are doing is a scale. It's a matter of scale. When you go from feet to inches to meters, it's all a matter of scale. So in this case, you want to be scale invariant. So you want the prior of sigma to be scale invariant, and to find such a prior, we do a transformation of this variable using this logarithm. So this sigma tilde is logarithm of sigma, the standard deviation. So what we, if we scale the standard deviation by A, so it's A sigma, in sigma tilde domain, this now becomes ln of A sigma, which is log A plus log sigma. Now, in this case, what we have done is, in the sigma domain, it was scale invariant. But now in the log sigma domain, now it should be translation invariant, because we want to neglect the component from A. Because in A, in sigma domain, it was a scale factor. In the logarithmic domain, it's now a summation factor. If you want to do away with this A term, that means this is a shift term. So we need to be shift invariant. So if we go back to the previous example, if it's got to be shift invariant, what we want is a uniform prior in the logarithmic domain. But if it's uniform in the logarithmic domain, this reduces to, if we go back to sigma domain, this reduces to 1 by sigma, 1 over sigma in the sigma domain. This, how we get from here to here, is problem 20 in your exercise. You can try this. It's actually quite a simple exercise if you know transformation of random variables. Do you remember transformation of random variables, how the PDF gets affected? That is, if you have, but you remember going through something like that? If you have a random variable x and you transform it to say y, f of x is y, and you know the distribution of x, so how do you get the distribution of y? Okay, this you can go back to your random process, and this is a simple exercise. There's problem 20 in your textbook. So this is non-informative prior in the sense it's scale invariant for standard deviation. This again is improper. That is, if you integrate this over the range 0 to infinity, it doesn't sum to any finite value. So this is improper. But the one problem with improper priors is it's still, even though we have reduced it to bare mathematics, there is still a bit of art in this. That instead of choosing sigma, choosing a non-informative prior for sigma, if we had tried choosing non-informative prior for sigma squared, you'd have got a different distribution. So in this case, now we have to choose between for which you're going to apply non-informative priors for. So this is still a design issue, but at least it forces us to define our assumptions. So The non-primitive priors are, of course, restricted to Bayesian parameter estimation. The other two topics that I'm going to talk next are more general, whether it's maximum likelihood or Bayesian parameter estimation. Sufficient statistics. This topic is a little difficult, or at least it's not a somewhat out of a normal kind of topic when you hear it for the first time, but it's actually not so difficult. Direct computation of the likelihood and the posterior for large data sets is challenging. This is in fact dealt with extensively by neural networks. So what we need is a parametric form for probability of x given theta. Example, Gaussian. That's what we do when we assume a Gaussian likelihood, when we have a parametric form for the Gaussian likelihood. The Gaussian case, computation of the sample mean and covariance, which was straightforward, contained all the information relevant to estimating the unknown population mean and covariance. I think you saw this in the previous lectures, where when we had a Gaussian parametric form, the maximum likelihood estimation reduced to our standard sample mean and sample covariance. So in which case, what we are trying to say is all we need, that we need for Bayesian learning or Bayesian estimation, reduces to a kind of statistics. In this case, if it's a mean, if it's sample mean, then it's, if it's covariance, it's sample covariance. So the overall problem reduces to one of filtering down the information contained in data to just a set of few statistics. It's sample mean or sample covariance. Such statistics are known as sufficient statistics. It distills the information and data to just a set of few statistics. Statistics is any function of data. So this property exists for other distributions too. Not all distributions, but for some other distributions. But at least for most distributions that we consider in practice. So if a sufficient statistic is a function S of the samples D that contains all the information relevant to a parameter theta. So, you are okay with this definition? That is, what we are trying to say is, what we need to do is find this probability of theta given D, forget this S for now, that is the posterior density. And for this, we will need data, of course. But instead of retaining all the data every time, if you get the data, just find a few statistics, and then you can throw away the data. This statistics is known as sufficient statistics. That is enough to find the posterior for Bayesian case. And if it's maximum likelihood case, that's enough for finding the maximum, the likelihood. So, again, I'm going to read this again, because if you understand this, then it becomes easy. A sufficient statistic is a function S of the samples D, that is all the data, that contains all the information relevant to the estimation of parameter theta. To write it more mathematically, a statistic S is said to be sufficient for theta if the probability of D, the data, given sufficient statistic S and theta is independent of the parameter theta. So what we have here is the probability of theta given both the sufficient statistic S and the data equals, using Bayes rule, probability of D given S comma theta multiplied by P of theta given S divided by P of D given S. Since by what we defined here for sufficient statistics, that data given S and theta is, these two would cancel because these two would be equal. Do you get why these two are equal, these two terms? Because we assume that P of D given S, comma theta is independent of theta. So P of D given S, comma theta would be same as D of D given S. Because independent of theta, by definition of sufficient statistics. So these two would cancel each other. And what we have is P of theta given S, comma D is same as P of theta given S. So this is the intuitive definition. That is, P of theta given S, comma D is P of theta given S. That is the estimation of parameter given the sufficient statistics and the overall data, all the data, is equal to the estimation of parameter theta given only the sufficient statistics. So which means you can throw away data once we have sufficient statistics. The factorization theorem. The theorem states that a statistic S is sufficient for theta if and only if P of D given theta can be written as P of data given theta is a function Z of only S and theta, the sufficient statistics and the parameters, and another function H of only data. So what this in fact does is, here we have the probability of data given the parameters, we are splitting it as two functions. In this function, we reduce it only to sufficient statistics, and there is no more data in this, no more direct dependence of data in this. Here, we have only the data, so this way, we remove the part that doesn't have any information for estimation of the parameter in this, for this particular parameter. Later we will see in the example, when we do this for mean, all the mean related parameter, the mean itself would be here, and also the sample mean. But the rest of the distribution, that is what we are decomposing here, is the overall distribution, and we are splitting the overall distribution into two parts. So when we are finding the distribution in terms of mean, the covariance part would distill out separately. We won't need that for estimation of mean. So the sample mean would just come into this Z. There are many ways to formulate sufficient statistics. Example, define a vector of samples themselves. Do you agree with that? Because if we have all the samples, that means it's still a sufficient statistic. We got all the information contained in the data that is needed for finding the parameters. But of course, this is not so useful. The whole idea of sufficient statistic is so that we can sort of compress the information in the data into just a set of few statistics. So, sufficient statistics is useful only when the function G and the sufficient statistics are simple. Example, sample mean calculation. So in the case of sample mean, all the data is reduced to just one information, which is the sample mean. So there, sufficient statistics is useful. The factoring of the probability of data given theta is not unique. This again is obvious. I can even say, multiply, say, 2 times G of the S, comma theta, and call this my new G, and divide H of D by 2. This is my new H. So even here I've got a decomposition which satisfies the definition of sufficient statistics. But the point I'm trying to prove here, it's not unique. Is it right? So more generally we can write it this way. The factoring of P of T given theta is not unique, because I can multiply this G of S comma theta by any function f of s, and divide h of d by the same function f of s. Still the product would lead to the same decomposition. So to try to define a unique such decomposition, what we can do is we can form a normalized g using this formula, which is g of s comma theta divided by integral of g of s comma theta over all theta. So using this, there can be only one such g of tilde. So this should lead to a unique density called the kernel density, which is invariant to scaling. The significance, most practical applications of parameter estimation involve simple sufficient statistics and simple kernel densities. In fact, for most Bayesian estimation, if you have the kernel density, the posterior would finally in the long term in the long what the for the word for it, when you have a lot of data, it reduces to this kernel density, the posterior distribution. Yeah, the asymptotic distribution. That's the word I was looking for. The asymptotic distribution reduces to a kernel density. So here is an example with Gaussian distribution for mean, with mean parameters. So we know the probability of data given theta is this expression. And since we assume the each data is independent of other, we can reduce the overall distribution to a product of distributions. Now this part we can just separate out and just multiply by yeah, this is wrong. There should be n here. So it's 2 pi per d by 2. There should be n times because it's multiplied n times. So even here this should be n times when the determinant of sigma power n by 2. There's a mistake here. Okay. But inside the exponential, the product of exponentials become summation. The exponential of minus half summation of whatever is inside. Now, by multiplying out this, we get this expression. And yeah, we can write this as exponential of, okay, what happened to this? Oh yeah, okay. So this part you write it later in this case. And here you have theta transpose sigma inverse theta here. And minus n by 2 comes from the summation. And then, yeah. Theta transpose sigma inverse and summation of x transpose comes here. Since we assume sigma as a constant, this term comes out. And this term we retain it. Yeah, this should be another term, xk here too. That's another mistake here. Because when it's multiplied out, you'll get xk transpose sigma inverse xk. That's what you get here. So, here we see this part is isolated. This isolates the theta dependence in the first term, and hence the sample mean is a sufficient statistic using the factorization theorem. If you go back, what we saw as sufficient statistic is contained in this term with theta. The second term doesn't have any theta and this just has only dependence on the actual samples themselves. So here what we have is the theta term is restricted to this and this term doesn't have anything to do with theta. So for mean, this is d and this would be h. This is the decomposition for p of d given theta. No. So, what is the sufficient statistic here? Yeah. So, it's this term. Because what we have here is g of theta comma s. The only s here, s is a function of samples, only samples. And the only function of samples is this. So this is the sufficient statistic in this case. Okay. And this is, of course, a sample. This is proportional to sample mean. And as we saw, sufficient statistic is only up to a scale factor. So the kernel is, so if you go back, we define the kernel density as g of s comma theta divided by integral of g of s comma theta over all theta. So if you call this as g, and so the normalized g or the kernel density becomes this. So what we saw the previous example was for a Gaussian case. In a more general exponential family case, what we have is probability of x given theta is this alpha x times exponential of a of theta plus b theta power t times c of theta. And so p of d given theta becomes this by assumption of independence of samples. So I just multiply this out for n samples and we get this expression. This becomes, since a of theta is independent of x, when we multiply this n times for various samples, we get exponential of n times a of theta plus b of theta power t summation of c of xk. This should be x here, c of x, multiplied by the product of alpha of x of k. So in this case, again, we see that clearly the term associated with theta and x is this part, what is inside the exponential. And this part is independent of theta. So this is h and this part is g. So the sufficient statistic here would be the summation of c times xk. So in the textbook, this is from the textbook, this gives a table of various distributions and their sufficient statistics along with the kernel density functions. So the next topic we are going to talk about is to do with data considerations, computational complexity, overfitting, and dimensionality. Feature vectors typically have dimensions greater than 50. In speech, with what I'm working with, the most common feature vector dimension is about 39, 40. In some cases, it goes to even 70. So which is quite high. Then we consider the problem of the curse of dimensionality. What is this curse of dimensionality? If you go back and see the covariance matrix estimation, so if I give you n feature vectors, what is the dimension of covariance matrix? You know what? N by n? Right. So it's n by n. How many terms are independent in that? The covariance matrix is symmetric. So it still would be about n times n plus 1 by 2. The point is, it's still order of n squared. So if we have a lot of dimensions, it's going to grow quite fast. The number of parameters that we have to estimate is going to grow quite fast. It becomes very difficult to estimate this many parameters in practice with just limited amount of data. So we'll get to that in more detail now. That's one of the major problems. So classification accuracy depends upon the dimensionality and the amount of training data. Consider the case of two classes, multivariate normal with the same covariance. In this case, the probability of error we can compute it to be this. 1 over root 2 pi integral going from r over 2 to infinity e power minus u squared by 2 du, where r squared is mu 1, that is the difference between the mean transpose inverse of covariance matrix times difference between the means. And from this we see, as we keep increasing r, the integral, so the, both the lower limit and the upper limit is anyway fixed at infinity. As r goes to infinity, the lower limit also would go to infinity, right? So this integral would go to zero. So as r tends to infinity, the probability of error tends to zero. If the features are independent, then what we have here, the covariance matrix is going to be a diagonal. So r squared would then reduce to this. So here we see that r squared is always an increasing function of number of features. If you have, say, another feature, if you have, say, d features, we will have a particular r. If we increase another feature, it cannot, the r can only increase because of the squared. You get this? It's a sum of squares. So if you have had a new term, it cannot decrease. At the worst, it can only remain equal. Either it remains equal or increases. So if you add a feature, r increases. And if r increases, the probability of error decreases from this. So theoretically, it goes to say that as we increase features, probability of error should decrease. But in practice, this doesn't always work beyond a point. What are the reasons? Can you guess what the reasons could be? Overtraining? Yeah. Okay. Is that the only problem? The other problem is, just now what I was telling, for with covariance matrix, the number of parameters is too huge. So we may not have enough data samples to estimate those parameters. So it also becomes a problem of parameter estimation accuracy. Did he talk about variance of parameter estimates? I think he should have in the beginning. When he talked about estimation of mean, then you should have talked about the variance of the estimate. Right? So there you'd have seen, as the number of data points increase, the variance decreases. So if we just have few data points, that means the variance of estimate is very low, which again means that we haven't estimated, the estimate is a very poor estimate of the true value of the parameter. So if we have too many parameters, the number of actual data samples that goes into estimation is very few. So the accuracy of the estimate is bad. So what we estimate is not good. So this is another problem when we have too many features. Dimensionality and training data size. So this, what I said now is just, we just go into more detail. The most useful features are the ones for which the difference between the means is large relative to standard deviation. This is quite intuitive, right? When we have, say, two classes, and I've got a mean here and a mean here, if the standard deviations are very small, so the mean of this is here, and most of data is clustered here, and the mean of this another point is somewhere here, and most of the data is clustered around this place. So in this case, we can get almost 100% classification accuracy. But if the means are very close to each other compared to their standard deviation, say, quite near like this, and the standard deviations are quite large enough that they overlap, then the probability of error is going to increase. This is quite intuitive, isn't it? So this is what we are trying to say at this point. The second thing is too many features can lead to a decrease in performance. Why? So the two points that we talked about. One is overfitting, and the second point is we don't have enough data points to estimate reliably. So some of the ways that we can alleviate this problem is fusion of different types of information, referred to as feature fusion. This we'll talk about in the next class, principal component analysis. Increasing the feature dimension can significantly increase the memory. This is another problem. Just like, say, covariance matrix, if I increase just one dimension, it's going to increase as squared, which is quite a huge problem. The number of elements in the covariance matrix grows as the square of dimension of the feature vector. And so also the computational complexity increases. A good rule of thumb is 10 independent samples for every parameter to be estimated. Dr. Piccone says as the Dr. Piccone's rule of thumb. So if you have 10 parameters to estimate, it's usually good that you have at least about 100 samples to estimate those parameters. For practical systems such as speech recognition, this rule can result in vast amounts of data. We talk about millions of parameters in speech recognition, so we would need tens of millions of data, which is quite a large amount. This is just to get a few notations clarified. One is the Big O notation. If you had some courses in computer science, I think you'd be used to this from algorithms. So assume we have a function like this, f of x is 2 plus 3x plus 4x squared. Then we say f of x as computational complexity O of x squared. Actually, in this case, not f of x as computational complexity, f of x as complexity O of x squared. Because what it means is it rises as fast as x squared. For if you go back and recall the kernel density for the mean estimation, this was the kernel density. And if you see the different orders of complexity for every term, it would come out to be this. Sometimes, when we talk about order, we don't bother about the proportionality constant. That is here. In this case, it was 4. In most cases, we neglect the proportionality constant because in practice, that's what matters. The constant of proportionality is not a big deal. But in a few cases, it can be really very large, say 10,000, in which case this might actually have some impact. So just make sure that in the problem that you are considering, it's not really a very big deal. If the number of data samples is inadequate, we can experience overfitting, which implies poor generalization. So what is this overfitting? This will come in the next slide with a graph much better. Hence, later in the course, we will study ways to control generalization and to smooth estimates of key parameters such as the mean and covariance. So, Here, this is an example of overfitting. What we have in the, as black dots are the actual data samples from a quadratic function with white noise, white Gaussian noise added. So what we have here is a parabolic function with few white noise added. But if you have a polynomial with, say, order 10, it will fit these data samples exactly. There are 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 samples. And if you obviously have a polynomial of order 10, you will be able to fit the polynomial to pass through all these points exactly, in which case we don't have any error. But does that mean this is a good model? Yeah, no. Why? Yeah, it's not generalized. So if I had one more point somewhere, this will lead to a huge error. So in general, we don't want to drive the error to zero by overfitting. This is one such example of that. So it is common that the number of available samples is inadequate to train a complex classifier. So in this case, we can assume this 10-dimensional polynomial to be a complex classifier. And the number of samples is inadequate to train because it leads to a poor model. If you had lots and lots of samples, even this 10-dimensional, this 10-parameter polynomial would have reduced to a parabola by the rest of the coefficients becoming degenerate, zero. But we don't have enough samples in this case. That's the main problem. So you should always choose the model to generalize the data in data sample, the data size enough. Or you should choose a number of data points to reflect the model's complexity. So you can have a balance between these two depending upon the problem at hand. So some of the alternatives are reduce the number of parameters. One common assumption we do in speech is to assume diagonal covariance. So this would reduce n squared number of parameters to just n parameters. Assume all classes have the same covariance. This is called pool covariance. So in this case, we'll still have a covariance term, but the majority of the discrimination information or the classification information comes from the mean. But so we are throwing away all the information in the covariance. A better way is to do this, a better estimate of covariance. Use Bayes parameter estimation, that is, have a prior covariance information, say, using this pooled covariance, and then do a Bayesian parameter estimation for each class or each parameter. A pseudo Bayesian estimate, there we have this prior assumption about the covariance, and we get the new estimate of covariance, and we do a weighted sum of these two. Or a regularized discriminant analysis. This is just a fancy term. There's nothing. It's still somewhat similar to this weighted sum. But what we do here is find this pool covariance sigma and find the individual covariances for each class, sigma I, and then do a weighted sum for each class. So what happens is assume this covariance to be a point in some space. So this overall covariance would be somewhere here, and for each class maybe one, for first class maybe somewhere here, and the second class maybe somewhere here. What we are doing is we are moving the covariance for both the classes towards the overall covariance, which is more reliable. So that's why it's called shrinkage. We are shrinking the individual covariance values to the global covariance. Okay, I'm done with the class today.